A History of Moral Thought, Lecture 2, Being Good and Being Traditional. Why do we call it ancient wisdom?
The best way to understand anything that seems at first to be a bewildering variety is by relating them all to some common standard. The standard doesn't have to be assumed to be right, just a useful point of reference. Modern ethical philosophies seem to be a bewildering variety, especially when compared to the relatively universal consensus that we find in pre-modern or classical Western philosophy. So the best way to understand the ethical philosophies in our modern pluralistic world, I think, is by relating them all to the single ethical philosophy that was believed almost universally by the societies and cultures that our modern world emerged from, namely the classical Greco-Roman culture and the Judeo-Christian culture, and the synthesis of these two in medieval culture. That's also a very useful standard because most of the disputes today are between some part of the old or pre-modern view and the new or modern view. That's a useful oversimplification. So we begin by a short but systematic summary of the most important planks in the platform of pre-modern ethical wisdom. This traditional morality is still very much alive, in fact more alive, more popular than any of the modern alternatives in the minds and in the lives of most people in our culture outside of university classrooms. Our language pays tribute to it by calling it ancient wisdom. Notice that. We don't say modern wisdom, but ancient wisdom. We say modern knowledge, assuming that we know more facts than the ancients, especially scientific facts. But we don't say modern wisdom, which seems to assume that we suspect we may be less wise, even though we're more knowledgeable. If so, then we should be able to learn something from this ancient wisdom. I see at least 12 important differences between the typically ancient, traditional ethical philosophy and most typically modern ethical philosophies. First, ethics comes first, not second, for the ancient teachers. The single most important ingredient in a good life is to be ethical. The whole point of the good life was not life, but goodness. Moral virtue was seen as the indispensable way to blessedness, to happiness, to the good life. There was disagreement within this view, for instance, between Plato and Aristotle about whether material goods and success was also a necessary ingredient in the good life, as well as moral virtue. Aristotle said yes, and Plato said no, but both agreed that virtue was the main ingredient. Modern disputes are more likely to be the opposite, over whether moral virtue is also necessary, as well as material success. Our priorities have changed. Ethics was central, at least for the intellectual leaders in ancient classical cultures, Greek, Roman, Jewish, Christian, and Muslim, but ethics is often an afterthought for the intellectuals in our culture. I don't think there's that much difference between the masses in different cultures. There are moral heroes and moral villains and something in between in all cultures, but there's a stark difference between the intellectuals, the teachers, the mind molders of modern culture versus those of pre-modern culture. In ancient times, the teachers were more moralistic, more idealistic than the students. In our culture, the students are usually more moralistic than the teachers. Another way of saying that ethics is first and not second is to say that morality is not merely a means to an end, it is the end. The point of living is not just to live, but to live well, not just to be, but to be good. And therefore, it would be wise to sacrifice anything, if necessary, in exchange for being good. The ancients did not feel surprised or resentful when the need for suffering and sacrifice arose. They expected it, not just because of their primitive science and technology, which had not yet abolished so much of it, but because of their philosophy. They too could be part of the good life. In fact, suffering could be part of blessedness or happiness. A second fundamental principle of traditional morality, not surprising, is the respect for tradition and authority and obedience or conformity to it. This word conformity has a bad connotation to us today, but not to the ancients. Both ancients and moderns agree that morally good people do not just conform to social fads and fashions, to propaganda, to popular opinion, to what everybody's doing, but the ancients did want to conform to higher authorities, both to abstractions like moral values and to concrete individuals like the saints and sages and the great minds and great books that stored this wisdom of tradition. That conformity is no longer popular because the canon of wisdom is no longer in place. The consensus or basic moral agreement is no longer in place in Western culture during the last 500 years or so. Because of this newness and variety and disagreement, we tend to believe that man creates his own moralities, creates his own values, and different cultures create different values. The ancients were not cultural relativists, except for the ancient Greek sophists. They were just about the only exception. The ancients thought you could no more create or invent a new morality than a new universe. When we speak of conformity to authority, we don't think very highly of it because it connotes to us the arbitrary authorities of changing social fashions or political powers. But the ancients did think highly of obedience to authority because they meant by authority not power but goodness, not might but right. Authority meant moral power, not political or social power to them. The Chinese word te, for instance, in Confucianism and in Taoism, means that moral force which doesn't need or use physical force. The power of moral goodness in a saint or sage that appeals to our conscience and wisdom, not the power of rulers or propagandists. This is one of the sharpest differences, I think, between ancient and modern moral attitudes. The ancients respected conformity and humility and looking up to your moral superiors. They assumed something we moderns almost never assume, hierarchy, superiority and inferiority, inequality. To show how sharp a difference this is, I take an incident from my own teaching. I teach a course on death and life after death, and I wrote a book for that course called Everything You Ever Wanted to Know About Heaven But Never Dreamed of Asking. There were hundreds of interesting questions in the book, such as, is there sex in heaven, and is there really a hell, and how do you get there? Questions I thought students would find pretty important. But every single time I ask them to argue about any of the points in the book, they always pick one little paragraph first, where I ask the question, will we all be the same in heaven? And I argue that the right answer is no, because then we would be lacking one of the greatest pleasures we have on earth, namely learning from those wiser and better than us. Well, almost all my students were shocked that I didn't think heaven was a democracy. I invited them to argue about it, and I remember one wrote, "If heaven isn't equality, I hope I never go there." When I asked her whether she meant equality with God too, she replied, "Of course, I prefer a God I can feel comfortable with." I asked her whether she really would rather have a God who was no wiser or more beautiful than herself, and she seemed really surprised that anyone would think that way. A third assumption of the ancients about ethics is that you do it by reason, by mind, not by feeling and emotion. If Moses or Solomon or Socrates or Plato or Aristotle or Aquinas were transplanted into contemporary America, I think the two things that would probably shock him the most would be how much reverence we have for feeling and how little for reason. And that would, in his mind, probably explain why we have changed one part of traditional morality in content the most, namely sexual morality. For both these reasons, the centrality of feeling and of sex, he would probably single out Freud as the single most influential thinker of modern times. Live according to reason is probably the most universally accepted of all ancient moral principles. Socrates and Plato seem to go so far as to say that reason is the only thing necessary for virtue. If only you know the good, you will do it. If only you have wisdom, if only you are wise enough to know that you can't possibly attain happiness without moral virtue, then you would always be virtuous. Aristotle, who was more commonsensical, disagrees with that, but he too makes moral goodness largely dependent, though not wholly dependent, on reason and mind. Live according to reason. That's a fundamental moral principle of all schools of ancient wisdom. Socrates, Plato, Aristotle, the Stoics, the Epicureans, the ancient Jewish and Christian philosophers too, even though they had a more expanded notion of reason and wisdom that also included a relation to faith and to the supernatural. Solomon says in the Proverbs, "Keep your mind with all diligence, for out of it are all the issues of life." The first line of Buddhism's most popular book, the Dhammapada, says, "All that we are is dependent on our thoughts." And right mindfulness is probably the most important of the eight principles in Buddha's Noble Eightfold Path to Enlightenment. The reason the ancients emphasized reason more than the moderns do is that they had a much broader concept of reason. Reason meant to them not just calculation, not just logic, and not just scientific method, but wisdom, understanding, something intuitive as well as logical. When they defined man as the rational animal, they didn't mean merely an ape with a computer and a laboratory. Here is another fourth difference between ancient and modern ethics. Ancient ethics was more like religion, or at least more open to religion, more connected to religion. Modern ethics is deliberately non-religious, not necessarily anti-religious, though sometimes it is that, but it's determined not to base itself on religion or to depend on religion. I think this is not only because religion had a far greater public and social force in ancient times, but also because it had a virtual monopoly in most ancient societies. There was a religious consensus, which no longer exists. We live in a pluralistic society, and our memories are scarred with the horrors of religious wars that tore Western civilization apart, and did so much to disgrace religion and to cause it to lose so much of its social force. Perhaps this secularization of our social order has only changed that religious force from a political force to a purely spiritual force. Perhaps religion has actually been strengthened and purified by its political disestablishment. But whether that's so or not, modern ethics is less closely allied to religion. And that's probably one of the reasons why modern ethics tends to shy away from the question of the meaning of life, the greatest good, which I've called the most important ethical question of all, because that question sounds religious, and therefore, the modern mind thinks, divisive and dangerous. Ethics, or morality, or a moral code, is part of every religion in the world. Atheists also have some moral code. Now, there's much more unanimity, more agreement about ethics than about theology among Protestants, Catholics, Jews, Muslims, Hindus, Buddhists, Taoists, and atheists. So, we in America have based our society not on any one particular religion, but on a natural law morality, or a philosophical ethics, a rational ethics. Moral controversies have divided America, like the right of women to vote, prohibition, civil rights, racism, abortion, homosexuality. And one of these moral controversies over slavery led to bloody civil war. But none of them were essentially religious controversies, like the wars that divided Europe, including the 30 Years' War and the French Revolution. Just to take the two most recent examples, religion motivated most civil rights activists in the 60s, and it motivates most pro-lifers today, but though religious people use their religion as a standard to judge what's right and wrong, and as a motivation to fight for what they believe is right in the public square, the controversies are not about religion, but about morality. But historically, religion has always been the strongest source of morality, or the strongest foundation, or at least the strongest motivator. Dostoevsky wrote, "If God does not exist, everything is permissible." Now, that may be too extreme, or maybe not. That's exactly one of the questions we'll look at later, whether an atheist can have a solid ethics. But obviously, if you do believe in a moral God, if you believe that morality goes all the way up, so to speak, into eternity and into ultimate reality, then you will naturally tend to take morality much more seriously than if you don't believe that. For this reason, I think, our American founding fathers encouraged religion, all religion, as the strongest support for morality, which they believed was in turn the strongest support for a just and peaceful and happy political order. That connection is very much in question today. Most of our ancestors did not think an atheist could be ethical. I think most people today, even many thoughtfully religious people, disagree. So that makes for our fourth difference. Here's a fifth difference. The ancients had a deeper concept of happiness as objective perfection of life and not just subjective contentment, and a deeper concept of ethics, not just as a set of rules, and therefore the ancients did not contrast these two things, ethics and happiness, as we often do. We often think of ethics as a set of rules that interferes with what we feel like doing, and therefore with our happiness. For them, ethics was the roadmap to the country of true happiness, blessedness, perfection, the good life. If you want to be happy, you have to be good. That was another universally accepted ethical maxim. Another connected difference between the typically ancient and typically modern ethical philosophies, difference number six, is that all the ancients based their ethics on human nature. That's one of the meanings of the term natural law. Those who thought human nature was essentially the same as the nature of an animal, like Epicurus and Lucretius, deduced from this anthropology the ethical conclusion that the highest values were pleasure and comfort and peace. Those who thought human nature was essentially the same as the nature of the gods or angels or spirits, like Plato and Plotinus, deduced from this anthropology the ethical conclusion that the only true values were spiritual, that material goods didn't count at all. And those who thought human nature was neither animal nor angel, but both spirit and matter, both soul and body, like Aristotle, deduced from this anthropology the ethical conclusion that both spiritual goods like wisdom and virtue and material goods like pleasure and wealth counted, but spiritual goods counted more. My point here is not that moderns tend to be more materialistic, but that moderns tend to be more skeptical of basing ethics on anthropology. They tend to base it either on desire and satisfaction, calculating the consequences of an act in terms of the greatest satisfaction for the greatest number of people, that's utilitarianism, or else on pure reason, abstracted from experience in human nature, like Immanuel Kant's purely logical categorical imperative, which is basically the golden rule, do unto others whatever you want them to do to you. Instead of any specific content based on human nature, like do not steal because humans need private property, or do not commit adultery because human sex is for families, not just for individuals, or keep a Sabbath because humans need leisure for their highest capacities to flourish. Instead of this, we have a kind of whatever. Do to others whatever you want them to do to you. It's like an equation. Instead of something like 7 plus 5 equals 12, we have something like A equals A. Instead of specific content, which could be right or wrong, we have mere equality between the two sides of the equation, which are the two people involved. That's the criterion for moral goodness, something you can determine by consensus, by agreement, without reference to human nature. Now, not all moral modern philosophies take these two routes, the utilitarian or the Kantian. Early modern philosophies did base their ethics on their anthropologies. For instance, Machiavelli and Hobbes believed men were essentially evil and selfish and competitive animals, so their ethics centered on power and institutions to check human nature. In contrast, Rousseau denied any innate evil in human nature, so his ethics is permissive and spontaneous. The founding fathers who wrote the American Constitution explicitly based it on an anthropology that denied both Hobbesian pessimism and Rousseauian optimism. They gave us a democracy which presupposes the ability of everyone to make good choices, but one with checks and balances and laws, which presupposes the need to check and the need for laws. One of them wrote, "If men were angels, laws would be unnecessary." When a lady asked Ben Franklin what kind of government the Continental Congress had come up with in Philadelphia, he replied, "A democracy, madam, if you can keep it." Here's a seventh difference between pre-modern and modern notions of ethics. For the ancients, the most important question in ethics was not how to treat other people, or how to improve the world, or how to have a just society, though those were all important questions. The most important question was not even what a good person was, what rules to follow, or even what virtues to have, though that was even more important. The most important question was the question of the meaning of life, the ultimate end or purpose or goal or good, the greatest good, the summum bonum, the Latin phrase for the greatest good that's become a kind of common technical term among philosophers. Now, if you believe, as many modern people do, that the scientific method is the only reliable method for finding the truth, then you probably won't have much hope that this question of the summum bonum can ever be answered, because the scientific method won't work on that question. You can't put the value of virtue, the value of money, the value of knowledge, and the value of physical pleasure in some test tube and see which one is more basic, as you can put chemicals in to see which one is hotter or heavier. But if you say that the scientific method is the only reliable method for finding the truth, I think you contradict yourself, because that principle can't be proved by the scientific method. It's your human choice to use that method, either always, or sometimes, or never. The method itself can't tell you whether to use it always, or sometimes, or never. You have to have some set of values first to tell you whether to use it always, or sometimes, or never. So some set of values and some philosophical assumptions has to come before using the scientific method. A materialist who believes that only material things are real, and therefore only material values are real, would use it always. An immaterialist, a spiritualist, a Hindu or Buddhist mystic, for instance, who believes that matter is an illusion, a dream, a mere projection of consciousness, would probably use it never, or perhaps only as a kind of toy. A dualist who believes that both matter and spirit are real, and therefore that both material and spiritual values are real, would use the scientific method sometimes. He'd use it on material things, but not on spiritual things. Ancient Western culture used to be mainly dualists, with a few spiritualistic monists, like Plotinus, and a few materialistic monists, like Democritus and Lucretius and Epicurus. Modern Western culture is much more materialistic, at least in its intellectuals, its philosophers. Here is another difference, number 8, between the ancients and the moderns. All the ancients believed that politics was social ethics, that there was not a double standard, no totally different ethics for individuals and for societies. The aim of society, according to all the ancient philosophers, was virtue. Almost no modern political philosopher believes that. In fact, the only one I can think of is Peter Morin, who was a homeless bum who wrote Easy Essays and taught Dorothy Day, the American Mother Teresa, who founded the Catholic Worker Movement on the Bowery in New York City. He defined a good society this way. A good society is one that helps you to be good. The ancients would have said, of course, to that definition. But the moderns do not. The aim of society is defined in different ways, and sometimes the question itself is rejected as the wrong one, but nobody says the aim of society is moral virtue. And the philosopher who effected that revolution above all was Machiavelli. Most modern systems of political philosophy are revisions and waterings down of Machiavelli's revolution. Here's another difference, a ninth one. Most of the ancients believed that human nature had both good and evil tendencies in it. Many modern philosophers believe that too, but three other views have become much more popular in modern times than they were in ancient times. One is that we have no essence, that human nature is just a word. and that therefore everything we find in us is put there, either by ourselves or by others, that human nature is malleable, changeable. The most extreme version of this is Marxism, which goes so far as to say that there is nothing in common between feudal man and capital man and communist man, that all words change their meaning from one stage in history to another. Another view, more popular in modern times, is pessimism, which believes that man is innately bad and not innately good. He's a selfish animal, and it takes force to make him act well. So ethics has to be unnatural, a curb, something like a bit or a bridle on a horse. Still another modern view, probably the most popular one in America, could be called optimism, which says that man is innately good and not innately bad. He is a victim. Blame social structures or circumstances, but don't blame him. Here is another difference, number 10. Many people today want ethics to be scientific. It's a popular belief that the rise of science caused the decline of religion, but not the decline of ethics. According to this view, just as in ancient Greece in the time of Socrates, rational philosophy replaced and gradually kicked out pagan religions in people's minds, so in Western Europe in the last four centuries, modern science did the same to the Christian religion, which had dominated medieval culture. So, if science has proved more reliable than religion, we should switch from a more religious ethic to a more scientific ethic, according to this view. Whether ethics can be based on science or not has to be argued on logical grounds, and I'll do that later in this series of lectures, but this history seems much too simple to me. For one thing, religion has not died, but keeps reviving. For another thing, science has not disproved a single religious dogma. For instance, it was not dogma but popular opinion that said the earth was only 6,000 years old or that hell was at the center of the earth. The decline of religion was not caused by science itself, but by something else. In any case, it's much more certain that science has succeeded than that religion has failed. The most obvious single difference between our civilization and all ancient civilizations is the success of science and its practical product, technology. It's what we are very, very good at, far better than any other civilization in history. Well, how does this affect ethics? The question arises, can ethics be scientific? The attempt to do that is part of the modern project, especially during the so-called Enlightenment, roughly the 17th and 18th centuries. If science is the only method for attaining objective truth, then ethics must become either scientific or subjective. And that explains what is probably the most important of all the differences between ancient and modern morality. The ancients believed the moral good was objective, part of nature, because nature meant to them not just what science can see. Most moderns believe the moral good is subjective, an art, man-made. Here is an 11th difference. In all ancient philosophies, ethics was dependent on metaphysics. Ethics, or your life view, depended on metaphysics, or your worldview. But modern philosophers are much more skeptical about the possibility of metaphysics. So most of them try to do ethics without metaphysics. The most influential and serious attempt to do that is Kant's. We will spend one whole lecture on Kant. Finally, a 13th difference between ancient and modern ethics concerns society. Most of the ancients would say that what makes a society survive and prosper is ethics, not economics. Plato's Republic, for instance, has one paragraph about economics and 10 books about ethics. Today, candidates for public office spend almost all their time arguing about economics, and almost never about ethics, until some scandal comes up. It's hard to exaggerate this difference. If you were to write to the king or the bishop or the shaman or the sage or the head of any ancient society and ask philosophical questions like, what is the meaning of life? What is the nature of reality? What is the nature of man? What is good and evil? You would get answers, official answers, answers the whole society agreed on and lived by. Now, if you were to ask those questions of any modern government, the answer would be, we don't tell you that. That's up to you. Modern society gives you more knowledge, more power, more wealth, and more freedom than any ancient society, but it gives you less meaning, less moral meaning. Most of us like that arrangement. We don't want our government imposing a philosophy on us. But that gives us an obligation far greater than people ever had in ancient societies. We have to find moral meaning and truth for ourselves. Each lecture will pit the ancients against the moderns, which means it will pit our own ancient minds against our own modern minds, because each of us has both dimensions in our own minds. We have to confront these 12 dilemmas in ourselves and in our society. But to do that, we have to think for ourselves. We all have to be philosophers. We don't all have to be scholars or professionals, but we all have to do our own thinking, because we all have our own individual minds. The answer to the question, who's to say, can be found in the mirror. But how much can the mind do? Isn't ethics more a matter of instinct and training than a matter of thinking? Can the mind make you a better person? Can philosophy, the love of wisdom, help you not only to think about what is good and evil, what is the good life, but also to live it? Socrates thought that it could. The first great philosopher in the world was convinced that the key to the moral life was wisdom. For next time, we will think about the role of thinking in moral living with the aid of Socrates. If you are inclined, and if it is possible, I suggest you read the Apology and the Meno, two of the dialogues of Plato, next time, because we will investigate the issues raised in those two little masterpieces.
If you borrowed this course from a public library and would like your own copy of the course guide for future reference, call Recorded Books at 1-800-636-3399 and we'll send you a free copy. A shipping charge will apply.